Hi folks, this is All Things Product with Petra Wille
and Teresa Torres.
And we're so happy you're here. Teresa, I brought a tricky one. Are you ready?
Maybe.
Can you share personal stories about moments that changed you? So either your perception about something specific, product thinking, a core belief that you hold on to, and then at some point you were like, okay, not anymore. So really kind of what were these moments that changed your career trajectory or something like that? Is there anything coming to mind?
Yeah, I can think of two.
I actually
think both of these have had a huge impact about how I think about work and my perspective on work. They both came from when I was a startup CEO. Mm-hmm. So I became a startup CEO in April of 2009. I took over a startup that was in a pretty big economic crisis due to the 08 recession. Ooh.
Why did you make that move?
I was the VP of product at that company. And okay. I really believed in what we were doing, and we were running out of money. We were selling recruiting software during a recession when nobody was hiring, but I really believed in the products and our future. And we were like previous to this, like on a rocket ship, like doing really well. And I was like, I think we can ride it out. And the CEO resigned, obviously, when we were running out of money. And I was like, I'll do it. Two really big lessons stand out for me, two very pivotal moments. So the first one was around this idea of like, okay, I'm the startup CEO now. I'm still the head of product. I'm now the head of sales. I'm now learning about how finances really work. Like I literally had to learn about, wait, revenue is different from cash? What? I was young. I was 32. I hadn't been exposed to a lot of this world. I'd been on the executive team. I'd been to board meetings. Like I knew how to read a P&L. I wasn't oblivious, but there was a lot that like is required of the CEO role that I was not aware of. And we were a very small team. We were very under-resourced because we were bleeding revenue like a lot of people during this time period. And I had this moment where it just occurred to me, like, it doesn't matter how many hours a day I work. Like I could work literally 24 hours a day and I wouldn't get through my to-do list. Like it was fundamentally impossible. And I was like, okay, well, if that's true, how do I make better decisions about what to prioritize? Focus. And I know in product, we all talk about prioritization. It's a little different when it feels like your company is going to live or die based on what you can personally get done.
Yeah, and people losing jobs, that's usually the hard part, right? So there is a big...
Yeah.
Responsibility part to it.
We went through layoffs 6 months before I became the CEO. And then when I became the CEO, I offered people choices about whether they're going to be laid off or take a reduction in salary. That was just the reality of where we were as a company. And so like these felt like really consequential decisions and there was no way to do it all. And I get a little bit of goosebumps thinking about it. And a little bit of teary thinking about it. Like it was really, really hard.
Yeah.
In fact, I went on Barry's blog post years ago and talked about this experience and like, I'm 14 years out from it and I still have emotion about it. Like it was just really, really hard. But what I'm really grateful about in that situation is that like now today when my to-do list gets too long, like I don't try to do all of it. Like I have this really core belief, I will never do all of it. Yeah. So like, it doesn't really matter how crazy my Trello board gets. And it does get very crazy. I have this like inner calm about like, it's fine. When you're feeling overwhelmed, it's about what's the most important thing I can do right now. And I can ignore all of the rest because I may never get to it.
Yeah. yeah. That's an important lesson.
Yeah. So that's the first one.
Interesting.
The second one was, okay, so also related to the same company. Here's the story of our company. We ran alumni communities for about 200 universities across the US. We were growing really fast before the 08 recession. We were adding new schools. We also sold recruiting software to companies, and we helped connect companies to alumni around jobs. And it was sort of this double opt-in talent network kind of thing. It was really cool.
Makes sense.
I kind of wish it still existed today. And but it was just bad timing, right? Like, you don't want to be in the recruiting space during a severe economic recession because companies stop hiring. We were running out of VC money at that time. There was no more VC money to be had. It was just like a confluence of events, almost all of them out of my control. And our board meetings, as they tend to get in situations like this, were hard. Everybody had an opinion about what we should do. I had board members that were not friendly with each other. It was very political. And I remember feeling stuck. I remember being like, here's what we've tried. Here's what our strategy is. And I remember being like, I need help. Like, I'm not sure what to do. And every single person in that board meeting, like, stared back at me and had no answers. And I remember, like, in that moment, it clicked. Like, I vividly remember this moment of standing at the head of the table, like, telling my board my problem and, like, asking for help and getting a whole room of blank stares back. And it clicked for me. I was like, oh, you guys have no idea.
They haven't done it either.
Like, you literally have no idea what we should do. Oh, okay. So I really do get to steer this ship. Cool. I'm going to go figure something out. And what that moment did for me is that, like, it allowed me to really
step. Oh, this sounds so hard.
It allowed me to really step into a leadership role of, like, okay, yes, you're here to support and to advise, but, like, you have no idea what I should do, which means probably nobody has an idea of what I should do because there was a lot of really experienced people in that room.
So before that, it was fake it till you make it. And in this moment, you were like, oh, I made it.
Yeah, I think I've always been a high agency person, but let me just tell you what that did for my agency. I was like, oh, okay, if none of you have an idea, I'm going to come up with a plan and we're going to run with my plan. And it doesn't mean like I wasn't open to feedback. It just meant like, oh, we're all playing a game and nobody knows how the game ends. There's not really rules. They're constantly changing around us. And if that's the environment we're going to be in and like somebody with 30 years more business experience than me doesn't have the answer, well, then we're going to go experiment. We're going to go figure it out. And like, I know how to do that. And so it was really like, it sounds depressing and it was like soul crushingly hard, but it was also really empowering. And coming out of that experience, especially in the business world, I really feel like I can do anything. I don't mean anything I do will be wildly successful, but I mean, like, I'm equally equipped to try things and to experiment.
Yeah. Than anybody else is. Yeah.
And so while those both sound like really kind of negative moments because it was a really hard situation, I would not be who I was today without them.
Wow, that's amazing moments of change, Teresa. Yeah. Thanks for sharing those with us.
Yeah, what about you? I'm sure you have really good ones.
Yeah, plenty of. So big one for me was maybe no matter how loyal you are as a person to the company you're working for, to the product you're working on, the company doesn't care. Yeah. So the story behind that is I was working with an organization as a product manager, was promoted to being a senior product manager, was working a lot of hours back then. I was young, no kids, just met my now husband. So, and he was working at the same company. So we had plenty of time together in the office anyways. So we worked long hours. I worked long hours. I was, as you, trying to do it all. And sometimes numbers were bad. And then we did a lot of feature crunching because then sales promised that they can sell stuff more. And you know the drill.
Yeah.
So I really tried to make things work. I really tried to make ends meet, and worked a lot. At some point, because the company had this set off of business owner, product manager for every team, and product marketing manager, by the way. So four people doing one job, basically. And then we changed it, or the organization leadership decided to change. We go full product management. So we did all these other roles. We kept product marketing to some extent, but I was then this new hybrid role of being the business owner, the product manager, and the product owner in one role. Of course, same salary, same hours in a day. And I was stressing out more. And at some point I was hitting a wall and I was like, okay, this is no longer healthy for me. I need to really leave this environment and the organization for various reasons. So it was not only workload, but there were various reasons why it was no longer a good working environment. And one super small portion of it was not getting any pay raise along the line. So it was just like more responsibility and more tasks and bigger teams and all these kind of things, right? But even after asking for pay raise, it was always like, yeah, maybe in half a year, you know, this round has been already closing. Let's see what we can do in autumn, yada, yada, yada. And after 2 years of that, I was kind of just so fed up with it. And I quit. And the day I quit, my boss asked me to reconsider and offered me a substantial pay raise, which was like, I think close to double my salary. And I really was like, okay, what the fuck? Why did they not? Yeah. I was asking like 1 million times you could have. And that is when I realized it was not my boss. It was just like the company as an organism and all the rules it has and all the processes it has and all the HR that it has and all the yada, yada, yada. And yeah, maybe to some extent it was my boss back then responsible for it. But maybe not. It was just like the system that the company built and the organism that such a company is. And the company doesn't care for the individual person suffering within the organization. That's why product people are so often burned out. Because product people are super loyal towards their team. They're oftentimes super loyal towards the product they're building. They love it. And they are super loyal towards the sales team, want to make them successful and all these kind of things. But the love is not coming back. And that was my moment when I was like, okay, so I definitely am the one that has to take care of my own personal well-being. I still love the product work. But it's on me to set the boundaries. And ever since, I'm working on healthier boundaries. It's still a journey that I'm on, I'd say. And I'm 15 years in. so it takes some time. And some days I manage it better and some days I don't. And being self-employed definitely does not help with healthy boundaries. But still, so there was that one moment where kind of I realized like, ooh, okay, I have to take care of myself because the company is not. Because the company is not a person.
I had a lot of reactions to your story as you told it. Honestly, like in the beginning, I think because I just
told my story. Visceral reactions? Or
yeah, like a lot of, like I just had a little emotional roller coaster. And I think part of it is because you told your story immediately like after I talked about being a startup CEO in a tough environment where we had to do layoffs. And so I was thinking about like, I asked my team to take on multiple jobs. They didn't get pay raises. They actually got pay cuts. And like, so I had a lot of empathy for the company side of like, we were trying to survive and a lot of companies.
Yeah, but there was enough money. There was enough money made.
Don't worry. I turned. So like at first I was like, I think sometimes employees don't understand like what is at risk and what is at stake. And part of this is because companies don't treat employees like adults and they don't share that information with them. And I wish that they would. So like in our situation,
agree.
When we asked our employees to take salary cuts, when I asked our employees to take salary cuts, there was no we. I will personally own that. I shared with them all of our finances. We didn't share salaries. People agreed they didn't want to do that. I gave them a choice, but we shared the sum salary number across the whole team. And they saw every penny where it went other than the salary block, how the salary block was divided up. And because I felt like if they were going to take a pay cut, they were basically investing in our company and I should treat them like investors. And I think like a lot of companies don't think about employees that way. And so they ask more and more out of their employees, basically asking their employees to invest in the company, but they don't reciprocate and then treat them like investors. And then as soon as you told your story about you quit and you got offered almost double your salary, I immediately was like, okay, this is not the same situation. Your manager, even if your manager is an amazing human, like missed that moment. Like there was several moments before that moment to advocate for you and to get more money for you, and it didn't happen. And so for me, that raises this question about like, how are we training our leaders? How are we training our leaders to take care of their best people?
That's why I'm training leaders these
days. Your like systemic piece about like HR rules and bureaucracy, like all of this interferes with like how
and
do we
sometimes
just be
even
human?
Reorgs.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just because and the boss that was then responsible was not my boss half a year before that. So he somehow inherited some of that mess, right? So he didn't create all that legacy. Here we go again, Teresa.
And sometimes people don't like, sometimes there's nobody in the organization who has the full view of all that mess, right? And that's where I think like you touched on it. This is often a symptom of like a underlying systemic problem. It's not that, oh, our leaders are being greedy or my manager sucks, or maybe there's little pieces of those things as part of the whole picture.
Yeah.
But it's usually the collection of things.
Yeah. And that's really kind of a company is an organization. It's an organism, and the organism has no collective wisdom or something like that. And therefore it does not care. The organization couldn't care less about the single individual because that's not how we're building these systems, right? And to some extent, we can build them differently and we can pay more attention to that. And every leadership person can and yada, yada, yada. Even colleagues could advocate for other colleagues sometimes in some organizations. But still, so that was definitely one moment. And the other one is a bit more obvious, I'd say. And it was really, it's always wild if I shared that, because it's really something basic as my first user interview.
Love it.
Yeah. So somebody called Marty Kagan forced little Petra to do the first, so Germany, we talk about, I don't know, 2007. Maybe there were 5 Starbucks open in Germany back at that time. There was 1 in Hamburg. So Starbucks, not a thing. And I know if I say to Americans like a Starbucks interview, they were like, yeah, what's special about a Starbucks interview? So coffee shops, big coffee shop chains, not a massive thing back then. And then Marty suggested you could just like, you have a B2C product. So it is basically every person with a job could be one of your users. So go down to the local Starbucks, and it was actually just a block away, and then talk to people that have a job about how they would look for a job. And this is what is a user interview. And everyone on our product team was like, oh, this sounds, who wants to do this? Who is volunteering to do this freaky thing? And then it was really like, okay, 2 people have to volunteer. And I was like, yeah, okay, I can do it. And it was shy. I didn't want to talk to strangers. I didn't want to be the weirdo showing up in the random Starbucks and say like, hey, can I buy you a coffee and ask you 5 questions? But I was like, okay, somebody has to do it. And then it was such a fun afternoon. And of course, we learned 1,000,000 things, amazing insights. And we did it on a weekly basis ever since, as at least as long as I was working for the organization. At some point it gets more professional. We invited the people to our own labs and blah, blah, blah. And before that, I was rather convinced that talking to users, what should they be able to tell us, Teresa? That was basically my, one of the big aha moments. I was like, oh, there's actually real findings in what people are sharing in these interviews. Yeah.
I didn't know that was because of Marty.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
He was teaching a class, and then he started to coach some of the product team at least. And of course, you know, Marty, user research always was important to him as well. And he saw us not doing any user research basically. I think we did this focus groups, which everybody hated, and surveys. I think that's what we did. And he was like, no, this is not, we go do Starbucks interviews next week, prepare for that, people. And then we did.
You're making me think of another really silly moment, because it's kind of related to this. It was probably 2004, I had done plenty of usability studies before, but this one stands out in my life because it was shocking to me. I was working at a search engine company. We focused on like product search, so like product reviews and then price comparison. And so it's kind of a shopping search engine. And we had just launched. I worked there like before we had a product, so very much 0-to-1 product management. We had just launched. And we were in an office building, one of the buildings that used to be Silicon Valley Graphics. Is that what they were called? I think so. And then yeah, Google took over. Like that. Google bought the buildings, and we were like renters in this office building. And in our building, it was all small companies. And so to recruit, I walked over to the building, the office next to ours, and I met, I think his name was Matt, their like office manager. I was like, hey, Matt, will you come over and test out our product? And he brought his laptop. And we're sitting in our conference room, and I go, Matt, can you open your web browser and type in, the company was called Become. So I was like, can you type in become.com? And he was like, what? I was like, can you open your web browser? And he's like, I don't know what you mean. And I was like, oh, how do you use the internet? He's like, I don't know. It's just there on my computer. Like, he didn't know how to open a web browser. And I had literally had to be like, do you see that little, E icon for Internet Explorer, like on your desktop right there? Can you click on that? And he's like, yeah, okay. And so he clicks on it. And it opened, like his homepage was like some portal. This was like the age of portals. So it was probably like Yahoo's homepage or something. And I was can you go to become.com? He was typing it in the Yahoo search bar. And I'm like, no, in your address bar up at the top, like the URL bar. And he's like, what? It probably took us 20 minutes just to get him to our homepage so that I could start the test. This was in Mountain View, California. Like, I was in a Google building when this happened, like in the heart of the tech industry. And I remember being
You are not your user, Teresa. You are not your user.
Yeah. And also, it was like 2004. It wasn't 1997. And so I remember standing there going, Teresa, you live in a bubble. Get outside. Talk to people that don't work in tech.
Yeah. So... yeah. But it's a good aha moment.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I remember I had an admin work for me. She also lives in Mountain View, California. She's also pretty tech savvy. She uses all the same technology we do. And when she started working for me, within like a week, she goes, Teresa, can you tell me how you put those things in your email that you can click on? I'm like, what? And she goes, sometimes you write emails to me and you make it so that I can click on the word and it goes to a web page. I go, links? You don't know how to do a link in your email? And she's like, no. I go, everybody knows how to do a link in emails. This was now like 2015, right? And she's not a dummy. And she's very tech savvy for the most part. She just literally had never made a link in an email. So much so that she was a good friend of mine. And she had teenage kids. And I go, I bet both your kids know how to put links in emails. She goes, no, they don't. And I made her ask her. Both of her kids knew how to put links in emails, which I realized made me look like a jerk. Like, why am I trying to make her feel bad for not knowing how to put a link in an email? One of those moments of like what we take for granted that like don't know how to do.
No, I had a similar one with the sales team. Actually, I was working on the software that would help them to kind of do some of their sales work while they were on the road. So it was really an on-the-road sales team working for a big printing business. And I was doing initial training for them because they all got equipped with it was something before the age of Blackberries.
Oh, anyways, yeah.
It was really the small handheld computers,
like Palm Pilots? Rather,
slightly bigger than Palm Pilots. But anyways, I dig it out and we put it in the show notes just for the sake of historic computer knowledge. Anyways, and they were rather ruggedized, so that's why they handed it to the sales team. Oh. It was easy for them to use them and stuff like that. So that was why they picked them. I think they were called iPacks. Anyways. Okay. So we built the software. It was super basic HTML back then, as you can imagine. It was touch screens already, but we're talking kind of grayscale black touch screens. And it was training with one of them while he was in his car in front of a grocery store where he had to go in and put in some of the data. And at some point I say, like, can you just like close the window? Because there was a pop-up opening on the screen. I say, like, close the window. And he actually did this in the car. And it really took me a minute to realize that closing the window is definitely not something that he has ever heard and he knows what to do. And after that, I rewrote the entire manual that we handed them with. So the entire thing was rewritten using different words and more screenshots and all these kind of things after that experience. Yeah, but we are now talking 2000 or 1999. So that was a while ago. But
you know what I just love about this episode is we started with like some very salient, like goosebumps, I teared up a little bit moments. And then we ended with some really funny moments that also caused me to tear up a little bit. So I think we did it.
Yeah, I think we did it as well. So fun moments, aha moments. If the audience has more aha moments, share it with us. We would love to hear your stories.
Yeah, we got to make this a little more interactive, listeners. So leave us some LinkedIn comments or some,
please,
some YouTube comments. We want to hear about your key moments. So now you have homework.
Your aha stories. Thank you, Teresa. That was fun.
Thanks, Petra.